From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack.
And I'm Emmeray Stein.
Thanks, as always, for joining us for our weekly wrap-up of Connections. Emmeray, what's up first?
We're starting the podcast with a focus on community building and revitalization. How can so-called Rust Belt cities take advantage of the digital economy to revitalize their urban centers? Andre Primus, a planner with Highland Planning LLC, argues that one of the most important pieces of revitalization lies in the stories that we share and keep alive about our city. Let's listen.
We don't get into the implementation a lot. We make plans. You know, we're planners. So we make plans and we pass them on to, you know, urban designers and transportation planners and things like that. And they, you know, make a plan. But to be able to then take the understanding of what that story is and make it into something that's real in the community is a whole other step that, you know, that's one of the things that I'm hoping that we're going to start seeing out of 2034 now that it's adopted and everything. Now we have to actually do it. You know, we can't let it sit on a shelf. And so to be able to take these plans that we spent the time to listen to people and understand their stories and make them into something real is kind of the next step. That's a transformative step. That's what we need to get at.
Yeah. Recently on social media, I saw my much cooler colleague, Veronica Volk, posted I think it was like a hipster development bingo. And it was all the things that American cities are trying to cater to the hipsters for. You know, and we're sort of blowing up all the any building that isn't currently used, so we can put in things like craft beer, hip coffee shops, taquerias. Like, it's all good. I like that stuff, and I actually don't have a problem with it. But the point was sort of like the vanilla same, as opposed to what's unique about a place. I would hope that you can do both, but I'm also hopeful that there is more of an interest in story and community narrative and shared history. I mean, is that just sort of my perspective because I host this show and we talk about it all the time? Or do you think in the work you're doing, are people more interested in that?
Yeah, they are. And I think that, you know, I think one of the troubles with Rochester general is we have such a strong history, you know, in the 1800s, 1900s, you know, with Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass and stuff like that, that we think of that as our story. But I think that there are a lot of smaller stories in the neighborhoods, you know, that have to deal with how they've dealt with adversity or, you know, the communities that came up around certain groups of people, you know, and we aren't always telling those stories. We kind of default to the stories that everyone knows, and, oh yeah, everyone knows Susan B. Anthony, that's great.
I actually wish more people knew those stories.
I guess. I mean, I feel like the people I interact with
I know, I hear you.
But I feel like there are smaller stories that you know, like, you know, even a medium-sized story, not a small story, but, you know, the Clarissa Street reunion, like,
oh yeah,
like, to be able to talk about those stories, yeah. Why is that the only, there were a lot more black neighborhoods that were destroyed than just Clarissa Street. But that's the only one that still has a reunion every year where they actually tell those stories. And so to be able to surface more of that would be great.
Next, a conversation about early intervention and various therapy services for local kids in need. In 2018, local advocates said a shortage of early intervention services was at a crisis point in the county. The situation improved somewhat last year, but advocates say there's still much more room for improvement.
We'll hear from a local mother named Megan, who discusses how those services benefited her son, Cooper, who was diagnosed with several neurological disorders. But first, local providers discuss the shortage. You'll hear from Sarah Callis, lead physical therapy and occupational therapy clinician at the Rochester Hearing and Speech Center, Deborah Cicery, a licensed speech-language pathologist at the Rochester Hearing and Speech Center, and first, here's Valerie Stotz, a licensed speech-language pathologist. Let's listen.
Oh, I'm not going to place blame.
Okay, no, well, see, I got to ask you. That's my job.
It's definitely state ed and county are both working in the preschool area to, in order to fund the services. So what part each plays and what they're, of course, they're looking at the other budgets. But obviously, this is so important to provide
these
services.
You're not going to apportion to any layer of government any sort of share of the blame, but what you're saying is there's a need for more.
They're both a part of it, so
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
That's fair enough. All right. So, Deborah Cicery, you may also dodge that question. I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
But part of our job is trying to really understand in the community.
Right.
If we don't have what we need, how are we going to get it? Do you have some thoughts on that?
I do. I think without assigning blame, I think we need to recognize this isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
People are leaving in droves, leaving the birth to five service provision because it's difficult work. It's not financially rewarding. It is rewarding in a whole lot of other ways, though. And that's why those of us who stay. We stay because of kids like Cooper. But recognizing that this is not working, and we need to figure out as a community, how do we make this job more attractive to young professionals and the professionals that are already in it? How do we make it so that they want to stay, so that they want to change lives like Cooper's?
Do you have a magic wand on how to get those professionals?
I do think that Valerie's point is well taken. You either pay now or you pay later.
Yeah.
And I think we need to decide that when children are birth to five, their brains are more malleable, they're easier to treat. We're able to make changes for a longer period of time in a short period, in a short window. Mm-hmm. If you wait till kids have been making the same error patterns for 8, 9, 10 years, it's much harder to fix. And we need to take advantage of that time when their brains are more receptive.
Okay. Dr. Callis?
I think everyone should pay. I think it should come from everywhere, honestly. Yeah. I think every single level of government, county, state, federal, I think it's an investment in our future. And I agree with what both of the ladies said. I can help a kiddo change now, and it's not rehabilitation, it's habilitation. I'm mm-hmm. teaching them how to do something in a way that helps them organize. You know, kids have orchards for brains, and you have to prune, you have to get organized in order for your orchard to bloom and have lots of fruit. And our job is to help them do that, because for a multitude of reasons, kiddos aren't developing correctly, or they're just missed a few basic fundamental milestones. And if I can help them right now put those into place, then they can be more organized. And that helps them succeed in so many other levels of development and education and become these professionals. Who knows what Cooper's going to be? It's going to be amazing. But I think we all have to invest. This can't be one level's responsibility, because if every single person in government had a child who had special needs, we would have more money. Because they would see the personal effect, and they would live Megan's story, and they would say, no one wants to not have what their child needs.
Isn't that so true, though?
Because his trajectory has completely changed. Completely. His attitude, his willingness.
The day he rode the bike... The best day ever.
Can you tell the story?
You can tell it, yeah.
So there's some sort of bike rodeo at the school.
Yes, and I was mortified.
And they were both terrified. We spent a lot of, that's the other thing you get at our level with the early intervention in the preschools. We do a lot of working with the parents, a lot of talking, a lot of educating. We then give parents tools to take home and work on, which is so much more effective. You cannot diet once a week and expect it to work. So I give you tools. I use them. You use them. I give you variations that you can do at home. And that way the kiddo gets it every day. That's really, really important.
And
Sorry.
You get to ask the question and prune it right there. Because, and let me tell you, I asked a lot of questions.
Megan asked a lot of questions, but that's okay. We love parents who ask questions. Okay, so there's the bike rodeo. And they're both terrified about it. And there's no way Cooper can participate because he can't ride a bike. But he really, really wants to. And I said, why can't he ride a bike? Of course we can ride a bike. So we brought the bike to the clinic, and we worked. We started right where he was. We started working on pushing it. We started getting on and off. We started doing other coordination skills separately that would help him be able to pedal this bike. And it was a lot of self-confidence, because at that point, we'd been working well. He had a lot of the skills he needed. We were able, at El Segal, we're riding in the hallways. They let us do so much. Thank you very, very much for the facilities there that let us ride bikes inside. And we got him on the bike, and he was so proud of himself. And I really think Megan cried. I'm pretty sure you cried.
Oh, I cried.
Because she's wanting to hang on and she's not sure he can do it. And I'm saying, he's okay. We can do this. He can do this. We've done all the prep. And he rode the bike down the hall and it was fabulous. And then he went to the rodeo.
He did.
And he participated.
And he participated. And he even said to me, he's like, Mommy, I'm just like the rest of them. I rode my bike. And
that's awesome.
And that was the thing, is for him, He was just a normal kid. He could do it.
Finally, a discussion about the value of respite programs for caregivers and people with disabilities. Respite programs provide a variety of short-term, temporary services that allow family members to take a break from the day-to-day schedule.
We hear from Patsy, mother of a teenager who attends Epilepsy Prelude's after-school respite and recreational respite programs, discuss the positive impact that respite has made on her family. But first, Stephanie Woodward, disability rights advocate with DisabilityDetails.com, discusses the feelings of burden that many individuals in the disability community experience throughout the process of caregiving. Let's listen.
I have absolutely no patience for viewing disabled people as burdens we are not burdens. We're not burdens on our family, and we're not burdens on society. And viewing us as such means that our society still has a long way to go in viewing disabled people as equal parts of our community and just as valuable to society as anyone else. I do think that everyone needs a break, including the people with disabilities who are receiving mm-hmm. services and care from family members or anyone else. And I think that that is why it's really important to look beyond just family members for receiving services and care, because just as much as a caregiver can get burnt out, a person receiving care from their family can get burnt out. And that's why it's really important to look beyond just your family to receive support, because you can receive support from other people and really get beyond just your own home and get out into the community. And you can receive that from other individuals in your own family, in the community, from agencies. And it can be part of your own choice rather than just your family.
I think I wanted to start with this word burden for a couple of different reasons. And I'm glad you touched on that, because number one, stigma that can be attached to disability as burden is already its own problem, for the reasons, some of the reasons we've already talked about in previous programs. But also this idea, the story of, for example, this mother who's now in her 80s, scared that, well, if I take a break, that this, I don't want to make it seem like my child is a burden, as if the notion of just any respite at all indicates that you view the work as a burden. I need a break from XXI sometimes. I get burned out on hosting the show. I love all of you guys, but I get burned out. That doesn't mean the show is a burden. I mean, there's sort of an ebb and flow to work. There's an ebb and flow to daily tasks, and everybody needs sort of a breakup of routine. But it doesn't indicate that if you need respite or if you choose respite, that what you're declaring is that the work is a burden. Is that fair?
Absolutely. But naturally, we feel a sense of guilt when we need help. And so we can also portray that on others. When another person needs help, we kind of push that guilt onto them for needing that help. Mm-hmm. And that's part of ableism. And that's where a lot of people feel internalized ableism. I think I've told you this story, and I've told the story to a lot of people. I have told my brother once, I need to hang this picture. I'm really sorry. I would do it myself if I could, but because I use a wheelchair, I just can't do it. And he looked at me and he said, no, you wouldn't. Like, if you could hang this picture yourself, you wouldn't. You would still ask me to do it. Like, I don't know why you're apologizing. Like, this is just not something you would do. Like, Stephanie, this is, you're not a picture hanging kind of girl. And I realized, like, no, I still would ask for help hanging this picture even if I could. So I don't know why I was feeling guilty about asking for help when we all ask for help sometimes, whether it's a task we can't do or we just don't want to. Lots of people ask for help when it's a task they don't know how to or they just don't want to do.
And I'll put a pin in this because we'll return to this. We're going to talk about caregivers, but also people receiving care and needing respite as well, which is an important distinction. I want to welcome Patsy to the program, who is Hassan's mother, who is a teenager. You've been listening to this conversation about respite for people in a lot of different parts of our community, whether it's caregivers, people receiving care. What do you want listeners to know about the reality for caregivers and for teenagers like Hassan when it comes to respite and those kind of needs?
What I would really like to stress is that, first of all, Hassan is my only child, and it took a lot for me to let go of every single thing that had to have anything to do with Hassan. I wanted to do the caregiving. I wanted to do the respite. I wanted to be his mom. I had an issue with letting go of some of the responsibilities and trusting that he would be in a program that would be safe for him, and also with staff that would understand his disabilities or his intellectual needs. Mm-hmm. So that took a minute for me to trust the program. And I find very good staff and success with EPI and CP Rochester. Hassan absolutely loves the programs. He's a social person, so he meets no strangers. Everyone is his friend, which could sometimes make me a little uneasy. That's why I like the programs with the respite agencies, because they're trained and they're knowledgeable with Hassan, and they are they participate in like his service coordinating meetings and know exactly what to expect or the expectations for Hassan and what he can and cannot do.
Okay. Now, when you talk about letting go, mm-hmm. is that back when he was 10, 11 years old? Or earlier than that? It was about when he started receiving those services?
Because he wasn't the type of child that would fit in really with a typical daycare setting, and he was getting older. So I was left with the choice of what do I do with him after school, because I'm a working mom and my day doesn't end at 2 and 3 o'clock. So I was introduced to the respite programs for after school, and we started with one agency there for several years, and EPI took that agency over. And like I said, it's been very, very helpful. And I see Hassan growing in so many areas, especially socially. He even started attending the Saturday programs with his friends, and I had the opportunity to see him interact with the various other peers that he's with, and it's a difference between night and day, between how he is around home and how he is with his friends.
I was writing some notes when you were talking about your concerns or what you felt about letting go. And one of the things that you said was, I wanted to be doing the care. I wanted to be doing the respite. And I thought, Patsy, you can't, I don't think you can do the respite, can you? I mean, like the break from, it's a break for you, it's a break for him. If you're doing the respite, there's not a respite, I don't think.
It's not. And it wasn't ideal, and it wasn't. I had to convince myself this was something for Hassan and put myself on the back burner. In order for Hassan to grow into the young man that he is becoming, Mom had to take a step back. And I think that was the best decision. And it gives me a break, especially during the weekends when he's on Saturdays. As soon as he leaves on Saturdays, I get my coffee and I just sit there. And I don't worry about him. And I know he's going to come back. He had a wonderful time. Sometimes they have extended times on Saturdays and they take him different places. The summers are absolutely wonderful for him. And what I like is I overlap the services between CP Rochester and EPI. So he has a group of friends in EPI, he has a group of friends at CP Rochester, and sometimes they intertwine. And he's a very social person, and I think that has a lot to do with the exposure that he's had through respite.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
You can also hear us on the WXXI mobile app. She's Megan, I'm Emma Ray. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll talk to you on Monday.